Charles Seabrook built some nice little houses for the Japanese to live in. He built a Buddhist temple for them, a small Buddhist church, we would call it, and welcomed them genuinely into the general community of Seabrook Farms, and they still are there. Well, all of this experience has made us feel very close to the Japanese in many ways. It's remarkable that during the war, I suppose there was no more bitter words said about the so-called enemy of any sort than were said about Japan, and caricatures and pictures of the distorting the figure of the emperor and of Japanese generally was very common in our press. Now it's 20 years later. We are some of the best friends, the Japanese and the Americans. We have very cordial relations on both sides, and a constant flow of people here going to Japan to visit them, and of Japanese coming here to study or to visit, so that one must never, during a war, if we have to have any more, let himself be carried away and forget the virtues and the values of the people who are called the enemy. Nearly always there is something one can do to take hold of that kind of situation and do something about it. One of the things that puzzled me all during these years, I would say beginning with 1930, was the strange and strained relations between the Soviet Union and the United States. As a matter of fact, the Soviet Union and the Western world. There was very little contact, no official contact in 1930. In 1933, we recognized Russia and had an embassy in Washington and began the slow process of getting a little bit acquainted. But the embassy people kept very much to themselves. The general attitude of the American was one of suspicion of the Russian, and there was very little traffic back and forth between our two countries. It has never seemed to me healthy for people to be shut off from each other. I feel that way now about Cuba and China. I felt that way about Russia in the early 30s. I don't know just how or why it happened, but for some reason I was invited to go to the embassy party celebrating the October Revolution. It was somewhat endangered his reputation if he was known to have gone to the Russian embassy. I don't think anybody would do anything to me about it, but still it wasn't popular, certainly. But I felt that the very fact that they had been willing to invite one to go, and that there was such little contact between the ordinary American citizen and the Russian, that I ought to accept. In the background of this, of course, was a history of relations between Quakers and the Russians. Mostly it was British Quakers, but Richenda Scott has just written a book called The Quakers and Russia, which tells the story of various contacts between our two countries. The most vivid one historically was, I suppose, more than 100 years ago when Daniel Wheeler, a British Quaker, was visiting in Russia. He called upon the Tsar, who then lived in Leningrad, what is now Leningrad, and called St. Petersburg, and found the whole town of Leningrad built in a swamp, part of it still mud and filth, and was impressed with the great danger to the health of the people who lived there. He was himself an engineer, a drainage engineer, and he began to figure out what could be done to drain the swamps and to improve the whole setting in which St. Petersburg was being built. The Tsar came under his influence to a considerable extent and agreed to partially finance the draining of the swamps and the installation of permanent sewage for the city. Daniel Wheeler himself, a man of some means, had to pay part of the cost of the enterprise. But he brought his family to St. Petersburg, five of them altogether, I guess it was, and the family lived and died there. I myself visited the grave of Daniel Wheeler in Leningrad some years ago. That is background. Then during the latter part of the First World War, the Russians parts of Russia suffered severely from famine. And Mr. Hoover, who was then the head of the American Relief Administration, asked the Service Committee if they would feed in these areas. We agreed to, and there are those living now, particularly Anna Haynes of Germantown, near Philadelphia, in Philadelphia, who were a part of the mission that administered the relief in the province of Samara, which is now, I believe, called Quibyshev. This was an interesting enterprise, but one accompanied by a great agony. The very cold winters were so severe that many of the people who starved to death because they didn't have food couldn't be buried, and they were piled up like cordwood awaiting the burial in the spring. One of the ambassadors whom I met in this country told me that he saw his father and mother placed on that pile and supposed that it was only a short time when he would be there too. But along came somebody, he didn't quite know who, but it happened to be these friends, some of them from England and some of them from the United States, and they brought wheat and other supplies which saved the lives of a good many people, although there was a terrible loss of life from starvation. This went on for about 4 years, and I went to Russia in 1930, representing the Service Committee at the close of our contact with Russia that began as a relief mission and then ended with a small center which we have conducted in Russia. From there on, the contact, I suppose, was based on that background. But I was always invited to the embassy parties in Washington, and practically always made it a point to go. I suppose many people think that these parties were largely drinking parties. I remember always seeing vodka in some corner somewhere, which you could get if you made an effort to get it, but it was not a prominent part of the evening. Most of the people who were there, one has to confess, were either Russian officials of the embassy or fellow travelers who were Americans, and I felt very much out of place from that point of view. On the other hand, I was looking to the time when sometime we might have normal relations. We might have many other people to meet the ambassador, who was himself a very able man, and that we might even conceive of the time when there would be people going back and forth between our two countries. On this trip of 1930, I visited Leningrad and the old province of Samara, where our feeding had gone on, and Moscow, it was a desolate visit. April, I think it was, when I was there, people were going barefooted on the street, but it was cold and dreary and gloomy. My memory was of feeling the sense of great poverty. Happily, in 1955, I was able to go back again. The standard of living had increased a great deal, still very simple as compared with what we were accustomed to in this country, but for them it was great improvement and constant feeling of being on the upgrade, which created a very different atmosphere. Well, these visits to the embassy from time to time, and some more private visits with the ambassador, persuaded me that the time would soon come, if we only watched for it, when there might be a much more free and easy contact and much more significant contact between the Russians and ourselves. I think it was 1952, probably, when, it may have been 1951, I'm not just sure, when the ambassador one day said to me, "We, the Russians, would like to have a visit from some leading businessman of the United States. If they will go, their visas await them." This seemed to me almost a startling announcement. It wouldn't be today because there's so much going back and forth. But that stirred my imagination and the imagination of our committee. It was the kind of thing that you couldn't publicize very much. It would have scared people off if it had been known very much. And I here don't feel free to tell all the negotiations that went on. Suffice it to say that over a period of 2 or 3 months, we had 3 meetings of some of the very leading businessmen of the country, a few of them, I suppose not more than 12 or 15, to consider this approach which the Russians had made, an unofficial one, to be sure. That is to say, I had no relation either to their government or ours, but nevertheless a kind of signal saying to us, the time has come when we'd like to renew some contact with you. I've always been very sorry that although there was great weight in the this hierarchy of businessmen, the State Department was yet fearful of having this kind of contact go on. And so they refused to allow passports to be issued, validated for visiting the USSR. In time, as I look back on it now, Many of these men did go on their own, but not all of them. But I think the ice might have been broken a good deal earlier if the State Department had had a little more imagination about what could be done. This effort to bring together two conflicting countries, the representatives of two conflicting countries, was, of course, one of great interest, but I assure you with a good deal of physical and some mental strain. And if it had become known at the time, I expect it would have caused a great deal of discussion, if not criticism. But it was one of the kinds of things that seemed to me that a friend with some historic background, such as the relief mission in Samara and the contribution of Daniel Wheeler to Leningrad, with that in his background, he might make some little progress. At least he ought to use that background for all it was worth. Now, of course, with the interest of Cyrus Eaton, an industrialist who has taken groups to the Soviet Union and has produced what's called the Pugwash Conferences of Russians and Americans, the very great and well-organized interest of Norman Cousins in having seminars in Russia and here, the continuous flow of teachers and doctors and students, young people, older people, back and forth under the aegis of the American Friends Service Committee and others, all of these things now are a natural and very desirable development. But in the time of Joseph Stalin, it wasn't so simple and easy. One was felt he was all the time under suspicion, and that the desire on the part of the Russian government to coexist with us was pretty weak. Well, these are some of the kinds of things that one has been involved in the past 30 years. There, I still, of course, feel a great interest in some way breaking through this, what seems to me, arbitrary and unwise cutting off of ourselves from contact with Cuba. I'm quite sure it's not going to undo the Cuban regime, undesirable though we may think it is. It probably only makes it more determined to bind the people to it and continue its existence. The same is true, I think, of China. It seems to me we have made a great mistake that over these now some 15 years we have had almost no contact with China. In the meantime, there's been some development, and the pace of development is accelerated, and yet we know relatively little in detail about what's happening inside China. We do know that they look upon us as enemy number one, and I expect many Americans feel that China is for them enemy number one. This is a dangerous frame of mind to be in. There are, as I well know by those who are now in charge of the service committee, concerns about breaking through these barriers that separate peoples. In some ways, the barriers seem to get greater. We, the very rich country, are at least the envy of some of the poorer countries, and we are dangerous because we are so powerful that we could demolish the world if we tried to. To speak from a background of strength is assumed usually to be an essential to enabling the United States to make its proper contact and contribution to the world. But very often, some small and relatively insignificant thing that happens, such as, for instance, feeding the people in the province of Samarra in their famine way back in 1920. All of that is very simple, very small, and very weak. And yet, because it is founded in the very inner nature of human beings to nourish and protect human life, it has a lasting influence. So, although one has worked in a small and relatively unimportant segment of the society of the world, it has been and continues to be a great satisfaction. One thing that I failed to say about Palestine, I'm putting in here at the end of the tape, during the period between the cessation of British control of Palestine and the establishment of the government of Israel, there was a period when there really was no government in Palestine, and the United Nations asked me if I would be willing to go over and assume the title of Mayor of Jerusalem. It was obviously a short-term affair, and not under the Service Committee, but under the direction of the United Nations. Well, I didn't feel up to this job. Furthermore, I had my work cut out for me in the Service Committee and didn't feel I could get away. So it was arranged that Harold Evans, a member of the board of the Service Committee, and James Vail, who was a member of the staff of the committee, both of them men of a good deal of administrative experience, and Harold Evans particularly of legal experience, should go over and see if they could render some assistance. They did go over. They spent only a few weeks there, never really, I think, assuming the title of mayor and assistant mayor, but trying to see that the water supply went on, that the electricity went on, the facilities of the city were continued, because there were constant squabbles between the old control and the new control. And then came the establishment of the State of Israel, somewhat feeble though it was at the beginning, and our men came home. So I have the subtle pleasure of being asked once in my life to be the mayor of Jerusalem. But I didn't ever assume the job. I never got any pay, and feel very grateful that I had the good sense not to try to do what I think others could do better. I think.